Never played with a player like that on this team.
Well, hello, Bulls fans, and welcome to another exciting edition of the Chicago Bullseye. Today we have a special episode because not only do I have Fred Pfeiffer with me today, which makes this kind of, I mean, obviously if you guys are tuning out right now, I understand. But we do have with us somebody else, so don't worry. We do have
How
more
dare
than
you.
Fred today. We have Andy Carnes with us today. Andy is he's an NBA expert, which means that he has way more credibility than Joe Crowley would ever have on this show. So that's why we invited him in here today. And Andy had an interesting experience over the last couple days, and he's gonna open that up to us, and we have a lot to talk about today. So how are you guys doing today? Thanks, Andy, for joining the show.
No problem. Thanks for having me, guys.
Our pleasure.
So why don't we start out, Andy, by describing – you know, just describe for us and for the fans listening a little bit about the event that you attended with one of my favorite players of all time, Tony Kukoc, and Bill Wennington. And again, the purpose of why we asked you on is the fascinating revelations that they shared with you about not only their careers, but also about our dearly departed coach, Tom Thibodeau. So, you know, just run down, if you could, first a little bit about the event, what it was. And, you know, more importantly, then after that, a little bit about some of the points that you highlighted during the evening.
Sure thing. So pretty much my boss had these tickets. It's called Fusio, where it's a club where they bring in a lot of times it's former sports stars. Sometimes it's current. But in this instance, Tony Kukoc and Bill Wennington were hosting an event at this restaurant in River North that me and a buddy of mine went to. My boss gave me the tickets for it, and pretty much it's just a small setting, very personal. There's I would say, about like an hour of cocktail hour where you just get to stand around and talk to the guests. So I was able to talk to Tony and Bill one-on-one during that period. And after that, you have a dinner, and they take questions from the crowd, and then they sign autographs. It's a cool thing, and it's a good opportunity to meet them. And you know,
yeah, hold on really quick. When you mean cocktails, how many people are in this room? Would you have 150?
There was probably like five tables of like, you know, six people at each table. So, I mean, it's not that much. Maybe 30 people were there.
Oh, wow.
Oh,
right.
My God.
A pretty intimate sort of setting.
Why can't I get in something like this? This is not right. I mean, Tony Kukoc is one of my favorite players of all time, and I never get invited to any of these things. This is infuriating. Sorry to interrupt you, Andy, but go on.
You work for the wrong company, Fred. That's why.
I guess you're right. Go on.
So, you know, that first hour was where I got most of this information, because that's when I was just able to go up to him, me and my pal, and we were just talking to him one-on-one, basically. And, you know, I felt that they were very genuine and honest. I mean, could they be sticking up for their pal and Paxson and stuff? Possibly. But I got the impression that they were – very honest, genuine, and they were giving what they thought was the truth. So I can tell you what they said, and again, I'm just a messenger here. This is what they told me. So
preach, brother. Preach.
So
sure.
First off, Wennington was much more talkative and sociable than Kukoc. Kukoc is much more to himself, but So most of the juicy stuff came from Wennington, and I think it makes more sense knowing that he's the radio broadcaster. He's in the building every day and a little more in the know. But so first thing was with Wennington. He said the only player that wanted Thibodeau back was Taj Gibson, which I was surprised because when I went to this thing, it was probably a couple days after he had been fired. So this was fresh news at the time. And, you know, I asked him, you know, there was that report about, you know, three of the starters wanted Thibodeau gone in the exit meetings or something like that. And he said, three. He said, how about the whole team, except for Taj Gibson, was the only one that didn't want him gone. So,
why would he say that to you, too? Like you said, in good point in saying it, like, who knows what their motivation is in saying this, but, you know, right there, I mean, he's definitely giving you some information. I don't see why he would have motivation to say that to you if it wasn't true.
He doesn't.
There's no motivation.
It's an intimate gathering of guys. He doesn't know that Andy has access to one of the greatest Bulls podcasts in the history of the planet.
Sure.
Come on. Yeah, so, but you know, that's the way Wennington was when I met him. But really quick, so how did this come up in the context? Did you ask him, hey, how was the team? Oh, so you asked him basically, what about the report where three guys wanted him gone? He said everybody
right.
wanted him gone outside the top. And that jives with Taj was the only guy who said, you know, basically defending him after that last game. Publicly.
Right.
Though Jimmy did go out to dinner with him, then this could mean nothing, but Jimmy
did go
out to dinner with him this week.
If you can't see through that as a ploy by Jimmy's agent to, you know, extort more money or whatever, or threaten the Bulls, that's what it was. It had nothing to do with Jimmy didn't want him back. But go on. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Yeah.
Keep on talking.
Yeah.
This is good stuff. Let's try to hear more.
I'd like to chime in on that. Just I got the feeling after talking to Bill that, you know, it's possible a lot of these guys do respect Thibodeau and they know the hard work he puts in. But that doesn't necessarily mean they want him to be their coach anymore. And I think there's a difference between the two. You can still respect the guy or even like the guy, but do you want him to be your coach, though, because he runs you into the ground? I mean, that's a topic. So
it's a very interesting take on it, too, because, I mean, generally when coaches leave, it's under extremely bad terms. So, I mean, you know, normally the players are happy to see him go. So, yeah, I think it says a little bit about the character of our team that they're able to hold him within, you know, a positive regard and a high regard, despite the fact that they don't want him to be the coach. I mean, I just think it shows a little bit of character for this team. But maybe I'm just beefing up the team a little bit more, so please continue.
All right. So I think this was maybe the day after Hoiberg was hired. So they said, Bill was saying, the day Hoiberg was hired, the whole Advocate Center was ecstatic that Thibodeau was gone, and he was saying everyone from the players down to the secretary to the janitors, they for some reason didn't like the guy. Now, maybe this was just this last year when the writing was on the wall that he was going to be gone, and maybe he was, you know, treated people wrong just then. I don't know what the case was, but that's what he said, and people can take that what it is.
Evan Moore, who's I follow on Twitter, who's a good follower on Twitter, confirmed that exact statement. Basically said every employee at the Advocate Center said it was a quote-unquote day of celebration when he was fired. And, you know, so, I mean, obviously the guy had a personality disorder. You know, he's a great coach, but I think it's pretty obvious if, you know, based on what people have said, he's not a good communicator with people, with anyone outside of the you know, realm of basketball. So, you know, for what it's worth.
It's interesting, too, because, I mean, once you get past the team, I'm just surprised, because everything you hear about Tibbs is that he was a shy guy. I'm just, what kind of impression could he have made on, you know, the secretaries or the people that are in the front office that are, you know, not working directly with the day-to-day operations of the team? I'm just wondering how he possibly could have rubbed them wrong. So that is interesting.
Well,
just
one note for all the listeners in general. It's the measure of the man, how you treat the least among you. I mean, how you treat people that can do absolutely nothing for you, that says the most about who you are as a person. I firmly believe that. So, I mean, the guy's a jackass. He's a great coach, but if you're not treating the janitors and the secretaries right, or you're ignoring them or not even bothering to say hi, you're a dick. You're a first-class dick.
I would just like to say that the statements that are made by Fred do not represent the feelings of the Chicago Bullseye right here. These are just Fred's personal statements.
What do you think? I am the Chicago Bullseye, partly. What are you talking about? It's 50-50, Mark. What do you disagree with what I'm saying? What are you talking about? Anyhow, sorry, Andy. Hey, one more question. Did you get the impression Wennington liked him, or did you get the impression Wennington was like, hey, adios, amigos?
So he started out by saying, you know, the first thing was, you know, there's a little bit of both sides to blame here, but if I was to really pick a side, it would be towards management. And then he just never said a good thing about Thibodeau. So I think he just did that as like a, just so it looks like he's not being biased, but I got an absolute sense that he was full on towards management side.
I appreciate what he's saying then. Because honestly, I mean, again, I'm going to go back to the fact that no matter what anybody wants to say, a lot of this stuff happened behind closed doors. But in my opinion, the fact that Tom Thibodeau never went out there and tried to say anything to dissuade these rumors, whether they were true or not, if he cared about this team and the success of this team, especially when they erupted after game one of the second round, he should have gone out there and just said, no, this isn't true. I love this team and you know, be a cheerleader for it, regardless of how you feel about it. He never did that. So right there, it shows me, because management had to do all the damage control when Thibodeau could have easily – I mean, he's the one that if he said anything, stuff would have, at least from the media standpoint, have subsided. So that right there, to me, is the tip-off that Thibodeau was, you know, clearly the person that liked having all this sort of, you know, BS following the team. But continue.
All right, so – Bill talked a bit about, you know, his time playing under Phil Jackson. And so he kind of, you know, an example of some of the little things about Thibodeau that gets under the player's skin. So he talked about, you know, what time do the players have to get to the United Center before a game? And he said, you know, Thibodeau requires that they get there 40 minutes before game time. And in comparison, Phil Jackson did, Phil Jackson wanted them there 40 minutes before game time, and Thibodeau required them to be there 2 hours before game time. So it may seem like a stupid little thing to us, but when you're playing every other day, you know, that's a chunk of your day that you don't get to yourself and you're there grinding. So it's just an example of Tibbs doing things hard all the time.
We hear about him having, like, full practices, too, throughout the season, which other teams did not have. So if you couple that with that, it's quite a huge load that these guys have to do. And it goes beyond basketball here, right? It's like these guys need to have a life. They need to be able to rest. They need to be able to get ready for the game. So that's an interesting point.
I caught that same point, too, when I saw Dunleavy. I remember this. I'll never forget it. After the Bulls had a 12 o'clock Sunday game, and they asked him, do you like these 12 o'clock Sunday games? He says, yeah, actually I do, so we don't have a shoot around. And it was like kind of, I've never heard a player say that. And the implication was clear that his shoot, quote unquote, shoot arounds were more like full fledged practices on game days. So it was really interesting to see that. Go on.
Friedel has said that too. I've heard Friedel say it. So, I mean, if anybody knows it, it's, you know, Friedel and Casey, they're there every day.
And, you know, it's just one of those things that, you know, for most people who just look at something like that, it's, you know, boo-hoo, poor players. But, you know, in the grand scheme of things, if you're living, you know, it's easy for us to say that in the background, but people are living this and playing the games every day. That does, you know, take a toll after a while.
Plus, they're not idiots. I mean, they know what the other guys in the league are doing. You know, so if the other guys in the league aren't putting up with this nonsense, then they're saying, well, why are we? You know what I mean? It doesn't matter what we think. It matters how the players think and how they are relative to the other players in the league.
Right. And I think the Bulls have done a great job at acquiring players who have these high character and, you know, they're going to go along with it. I could just only imagine if they had, you know, like Nick Young or someone like that. They would probably hear more about, you know, the issues that come with working.
Great point, Andy. And that's the kind of that's why management's been underrated, because they can't take in questionable character guys with him as a coach. It's just not going to work. And you saw that with Rip Hamilton, who obviously didn't buy what Tibbs was selling. And, you know, that went south pretty quickly.
And, you know, every time I hear about these rumors about Thibodeau going to the Cavs next year and all that, I just don't buy it. I don't think LeBron and him would mesh at all.
Never. Amen. And he's not going to the Knicks either, because Phil Jackson hates the entire Pat Riley tree, which is where Thibodeau comes off of, Jeff Van Gundy. All those guys come off of Jeff Van Gundy and Phil Jackson. All I got to do is Google Jeff Van Gundy, Phil Jackson. Those guys can't stand each other. So there's no way he's going to the Knicks. I don't know if people get it. I do potentially think
if he did, that would be great. I'd love to see him go to a team that does have some questionable characters on it. Even if he went to the Cavs, I agree with you, Andy. There's no way he's going to go to the Cavs. It's too much of a risk. I mean, you're putting in somebody that's – I mean, this is LeBron's team. He coached it for the most part last year, and you got to let him continue to do that. If he's not happy, this is all going to fall apart. But I can't imagine. I mean, most likely he's going to get picked up by some team that's crap. If you remember when we got him, it was he'd gotten many offers by teams, and he waited and cherry-picked the best opportunity. He got offered something before us from New Orleans, I believe, in the offseason. He didn't take it. This time, I don't think he's going to get that same opportunity, because I don't see a winning team. I'm sure that teams out there have an idea of what his reputation is, and I'm sure that they realize that if you mix up something on a team with somebody like that, there's a chance that it could go very south. He has not been good so far when we've had the most talent on the floor. He's been the best when we haven't had the most talent on the floor.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Go ahead. Sorry about that, Andy.
All right. So I'll run through something a little quicker. So I asked him about if he thought the Bulls had quit in Game 6 this year versus the Cavs. He said they absolutely quit, and he thought they actually quit the year before when they were playing the Wizards, which I thought that was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So also, just for the hell of it, I brought up Kirk Heinrich. And Wennington laughed. He said he loves Kirk as a person, and he's a great guy, but Snell should have been playing over him all year. And
amen.
Exactly. Yep. Not much else to say there.
There is nothing else.
Except for the fact that it's going to be very interesting next year, now that Kirk's opted in, to see what the dynamic is going to be between him and his role in the lineup next year. But I got to imagine that Hoiberg, hopefully, it seems like unanimously, the whole world feels the same. It was really just Thibodeau. Like everyone was scratching their heads.
Yeah.
Yep.
So he also, talking to Wennington, he seemed to have very high hopes for McDermott, Snell, and Nico, who they all pretty much ended the year on a low note, even though Nico had a great year overall. He says he thinks, you know, all those players just need an ample opportunity to, you know, get consistent minutes and work through the mistakes. He said, you know, he thinks that McDermott, Nico and Snell are guys that they have to be coached a little differently than your Noahs and Tajas of the world, who, you know, maybe their confidence just has to be rolling, you know, for them to be serviceable. And when Thibodeau yanks them one mistake into the game, they're never going to learn how to play through the mistakes. So,
amen.
Yeah.
It's 100% right.
It's stuff we've been saying all along that he's basically just confirming, but it's just interesting to hear someone from the organization saying these same things.
Yeah. I if I have one more argument on Twitter about somebody saying McDermott is a bust after 300 minutes in the NBA and a knee injury, you know, you're going to make that assessment with some jackass coach. When you get out in the court, you're going to make mistakes. You're a rookie. Every time you make a mistake, you're pulled. It's ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous and asinine, and you got to let the guy learn. And you know what? If he does play 600 minutes and he's still shooting 40%, 41%, well, then I'll agree with you. Or 1,000 minutes. But the guy played less than 400 minutes, and you're calling him a bust? Shut up. Just shut up. It's stupid. It's stupid. All right, go on.
I mean, that's the thing. It's like I'm not even trying to defend McDermott. It's just, I want to just see him get a chance, you know, legitimate one.
I heard Sam Smith on the radio the other morning, and he was talking about McDermott. He goes, we would finally be let into practice, and I'd watch McDermott shoot, and he'd hit about 30 in a row. And I'd just say, shooting is shooting. He needs shooters. And the thing with Tibbs is Tibbs would rather have a guy who's going to run his defense exactly how he drew it up rather have that guy out there like Turk than have a guy out there that can actually hit shots, you know, or right. have, you know, and it's just, you know, we've beat this horse, so let's hear the next one.
All right, so he was saying how Thibodeau always has to be calling plays, and that's something that will, you know, our offense is going to be so much more fluid and rhythmic under Hoiberg. He said every time a player was stuck with the ball, they would look to Tibbs about what to do. And he said that's exactly why we led the league in shot clock violations the last 2 years. And he said that's also why Thibodeau is always standing at midcourt, because he's always got to be right in their vision to tell them what to do every single play. So I thought that was interesting.
That's very interesting. Yeah. That is something that, I mean, you look at other teams. I mean, their star player is the one that can always make the plays. You have to let – I mean, it's fine to draw plays, but especially in the game of basketball, we have 24-second shot clock. Players have to have the ability to work based upon how they see the floor. And you've got a guy like Tom Thibodeau who's sitting on the sideline with a bad vantage point telling somebody like Derrick Rose who's looking straight on at what he can and cannot do. That's just ridiculous to be calling every single play – throughout the game. Nobody does that.
Right.
No.
I mean, it's ridiculous. I asked him, you know, if he thought that the Bulls would take a step back on defense next year under Hoiberg, and he said, did I think the defense was good this year? I said, okay. He said, they were terrible this year defensively. And he said, there's no way they're going to be any worse defensively next year than they were this year. So I thought that was interesting.
Well, I didn't think it was terrible. I mean, I do disagree with them there. They definitely weren't terrible in the playoffs. I mean, they had one of the best defenses in the playoffs. I thought they had some very nice moments in the playoffs, but go on.
Yeah, I looked up the statistics. They were, like, I think, 7th or 8th in points per game allowed this year. So they obviously weren't terrible. But if you're comparing them to the 2010-2011 defense, yeah, I guess you could say they definitely were a few steps down from that.
Go
ahead.
The reason is simple. It's, you know, everybody's going to say, well, that's because Gasol came out and knows out of position. No, that's because Thibodeau tried to force players who couldn't run a system into the system. Instead of adapting the talent the system to the talent, he chose to, you know, make the talent adapt to the system. But so go on.
That's actually exactly what Flemington was saying. He said Thibodeau tried to put everyone into his system. If it worked, great. If not, he's still running his system. So,
yeah, work harder. Yeah,
exactly.
That's his answer.
So one of the most interesting things I thought he said was he said there actually is a little bit of truth to the Jimmy Derrick beef. He says it's nothing, you know, that should be blown out of proportion, but there is a little something there. And it's not even so much that they can't stand each other. It's just a matter of Derek getting used to it not totally being his team anymore, which since he's come back from his injury, he's not used to that. So I thought that was very interesting.
Yeah, I agree with him too.
He compared it to, you know, if you were a salesperson in an office and you had the best corner office all this time, and then you went into a coma for a couple of years and you came back and some other guy was the top producer and, you know, you're not big man on campus anymore. So I think that's something that totally can be worked out, and, you know, I think Hoiberg will do a good job of that.
And you need a Steve Kerr-like communicator to facilitate that, and Thibodeau just doesn't have it in his genes to handle something like that. I think Hoiberg will be far better positioned to do that.
Absolutely. Other than that, he said, I mean, I asked him who was the leader of the Bulls this last year. What would you guys think the answer was?
Derek.
Derek, too.
He said Jimmy and Powell were the leaders of the team this year. He said, you know, Joakim was a leader in previous years, but this year he just, with all the drama and the injuries he was dealing with, it was really more Jimmy and Powell's team. So
what did he say about Paul? If so, was it positive, negative? Did he comment on him or no?
He didn't really comment on them. I didn't get a gist that it was either one way or another. But he didn't really comment on them, to be honest. Says Noah has absolutely no cartilage left in his knee, complete bone on bone. And pretty much he said he thinks Joe Kim Noah has 3 years left in the league, and after that he's most likely done, just because of his injuries.
I wouldn't say that's I would say that's entirely possible. It's sad, but true.
Exactly. I know.
Interesting. How about Tony? Tony share anything with you about like the old days?
They did. They gave us a couple stories. They talked about the last-second shot that Pippen sat out for against the Knicks in 94. He said pretty much Pippen had been struggling the last few possessions leading up to that point, and Phil called the play for Kukoc. Scotty took himself out. He said after the game, Cartwright absolutely reamed Pippen in the locker room for like 10 minutes. And Pippen apologized to the team, and everything worked out. There was no hard feelings. He said the media just totally blew it out of proportion. That's what Kukoc said from his mouth. So.
Kukoc saved Scotty Pippen's career with that shot in Chicago. If he misses that shot, the Bulls go down 3-0. They lose in overtime, I guarantee it. They go down 3-0, and they probably get swept. And Scotty doesn't get a chance to redeem himself. He gets traded in the offseason, and it's all over for him. So that shot changed, I think, the course of Bulls history.
I mean, it could have been.
And the media, frankly, rightfully got on his – I mean, they blow everything out of proportion, obviously. But in that particular situation, you made a stand during a game. The whole world saw it. No matter – you know, the team can forgive you, but, you know, we all saw what happened. And it's like, as far as just egregious things that occur in the game, it doesn't get much worse than that. So I get why the media has been jumping on him even. I mean, still to this day to some degree.
For sure.
That's right. It was inexcusable. You can't do that, especially when Kukoc had a history of hitting shots throughout that season. And for him to sit out of play, it's unforgivable. I still haven't completely forgiven him for it.
You know, the way Tony put it, though, it was, you know, after that night, they just completely forgot about it, and they never thought about it again. But we're still sitting here 20 years later talking about it, and he just finds that very funny.
Good stuff. Did they talk about Michael at all?
They did. You know, nothing that no one's ever heard before. There's a story. Wennington was saying how there was a day at practice that they were all just making fun of him because he was a big, slow, fat white guy. And it was sort of, you know, them all taking their shots at him playfully, jokingly. But, you know, Wennington pulled him aside later and he's like, you know, I get what you guys are doing. You're just, you know, I'm the new guy and you're poking fun playfully. I get it. Just don't do it again or else I'll kill you. And MJ said, well, I'm going to effing kill you then. And then Wennington told him he's going to put a snake in his locker or something. It was a ridiculous story, but apparently they...
Did they make up? Yeah, they did.
I mean, I think it was all sort of playful, but the way he put it was very funny. He's better explaining the story than I am.
So to go back to that Joakim thing really quickly, it's going to be interesting to see. I mean, obviously, if Wennington knows this, the whole management knows this. I mean, obviously, it has been something that's been discussed by the media as far as, I mean, we all assume that Joakim's injured, but we never really got any information on it. But it's just going to be interesting to see how we deal with it because you've got this cog there at center. I mean, you're going to have him this year. I think this is his last year, right? This upcoming year?
Yes.
Right.
And Andy, we were talking about this on Twitter today. I mean, how much would you pay this guy? Let's say he was a free agent this year. What would he be worth this year? And, you know, let's say he has another season like last year. It's going to be a really difficult, interesting decision to make.
I mean, I don't think you can pay him very much at all. I mean, if we're talking about the way he performed in the playoffs, which is horrible, I mean, he's a bench player, right?
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I hope that at least Hoiberg can be realistic and not play him off of reputation this year. And it's like, if he redeems himself and he earns those minutes, fine. But like everybody else on this team, you got to earn those minutes. We have depth at that position. So If he can't do it, put Taj in there, because frankly, there's no big centers in the East anyways. So if you have a good defensive center, it doesn't matter if he's 6'9", 6'10", whatever Taj is, he'll be able to get the job done.
I'm hoping that Fred gets his minutes down and Gasol's minutes down to the 25 to 30 minute range, gets him a ton of rest, gets him a ton of days off, and then Noah comes back as a new player next year. And you can do it. You got Nico, you got the rookie now. I mean, you got options at the 4 and the 5. So there's no reason Gasol should be playing 35 sticking minutes a night. There's no reason that, you know, I thought it was ridiculous that Noah was playing 32 minutes a night. They should be at 25 to 28 minutes a night. And I think if you do that, I have hope we'll be back to, you know, at least some kind of good form. But, you know, we'll see.
Yeah, I mean,
were there any other good? Oh, sorry, go on.
Real quick about Lennington, he said that he believes, and this was just of his own belief, but that going back to 2011, 2012, the year that Rose tore his ACL, he says, you know, if you remember back, that was the year that Rose had a lot of other nagging injuries before the ACL tear that he was playing through.
Yes.
The lockout season. He says, you know, Thibodeau pushed him too hard that year, and if he hadn't, he wouldn't have torn his ACL in the playoffs. He said that's just his own belief. There's obviously no way to prove that. But, you know, that's his belief.
I personally agree with that. I always have. I was furious when it happened. I remember a game in that season where Rose had a toe injury, and any type of injury to the feet or to the leg always leaves you to overcompensate, and it could lead to huge problems. He came back against some awful team, played like 30-plus minutes in his first game back. I mean, it was just asinine. And, you know, I've always felt that way about what he did to him that year. It was just inexcusable.
I buy it. Yeah, I can clearly remember. I mean, and he did this to everybody. Like, somebody would get injured, they come back after not playing for a while, and all of a sudden they're playing close to their starter minutes. He'd take them down maybe a little bit, but not the way that you should when somebody's coming back from injury. Yeah, I mean, that was a lockout year. I mean, we were getting – I remember there were, like, back-to-back-to-back games that year from what I remember. Like, you had, like, many stretches where you had a very you had a ton of games, like, right together because they didn't play – they played a disproportionate amount of games to the amount of months that they played. They had way more games than they would normally have after Christmas. And, yeah, they were playing the players like it was just regular – like a regular 82-game season. And, yeah, I never understood it, and I buy it. I wonder what Rose's take is on Thibodeau, you know, deep down. I'm curious if he feels that way, too. Did he say anything about
Rose,
Mark. what he thinks about Rose moving forward?
Not really.
I agree with you, Mark, though. I'm really curious. There's got to be somebody in Rose's camp who feels the same way you and I do, and Wennington does, and I think that's probably a source of – or has been a source of tension between the Bulls and that camp. You know, I know everybody tries to make in public that, you know, Rose and Thibodeau are the best of friends. I don't feel that way. I really don't. And I think at some level, maybe Rose doesn't believe it, but I'm sure someone close to Rose puts part of the blame on these injuries on him.
Yeah. I just have a couple other last couple of points. I thought it was interesting. He said he thought Skiles is a better coach than Thibodeau, which I thought I wasn't expecting to say that.
Wow.
He says he thought Skiles has actually adjusted some since being the Bulls coach. And he says if Thibodeau doesn't adjust his style a little bit in the next stop, he probably won't get another job after that.
Well, here's, you know,
be exposed. Skiles had a much worse team. I mean, Skiles' success here was with a team that had way less talent on it. So, I mean, you know, he got a raw deal because the team kind of tuned him out. But at the same time, you know, I mean, I feel like Thibodeau kind of got a little bit more credit than he deserved because of that, the first year that Rose was out. And everybody started, like, you know, stroking his ego. And the minute that you do that, it feels like you've just got, you know, carte blanche to do whatever the heck you want. And it sounds like that's kind of what Thibodeau did. Whereas, you know, if the team wasn't good and the team didn't respond, he would have lost them earlier and it wouldn't have been this glory story that we kind of had. And it's like, I mean, you look at what Skiles had. I mean, he didn't have anything compared to what Thibodeau had. It's not even close.
I totally agree with you, Mark. If you look at Skiles. Look, he won. He basically got as far as Thibodeau did this year in 2006-07 with a team that won 49 games, and the best player was Ben Gordon, who averaged over 20 points per game that year. And I think we could, you know, even though I'm the biggest Ben Gordon fan in the world, I understand he's not a, you know, an elite. He never was a top 20 player. Luol Deng and Kirk Heinrich were his three best players. So, I mean, think about that. I mean, I think that's a great point. I think Skiles is as good as it gets in the NBA. I've always felt he was an underrated coach.
He's coaching Orlando, isn't he?
Yeah,
and they're going to be much better this year, and they'll probably burn them out after another 2 years, but that's the world in the NBA.
Yeah, sure.
One last thing about what Bill was telling me. He said he was talking about the Paxson, Vinny Del Negro scuffle, if you remember that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So, if you guys recall, I think Vinny went over the Noah minutes limit a few times that year, and Noah, I think, missed a couple stretches during that season, maybe just a week or two that he missed, and after the last time, Paxson went into his office, into Vinny's office to confront him about it. Some words were exchanged. And apparently Vinny came up to John saying, well, what are you going to do about it, John? And then apparently that's when Pax, like, pulled his tie or whatever happened. So that's good for Pax.
I agree. It's just, oh, my gosh, we blow everything up. The one thing I got to say about our show is that we've always been consistent on our support for management, and I think that this certainly solidifies. I would like to say that we're not paying you to say what you're saying, Andy. I mean, you're coming straight from a source here, but it always appeared to us to be this way, and, you know, we on this show try not to get swayed constantly by guys like Joe Crowley that just throw crap out there just to try to ruffle people's feathers, and everybody was jumping on every piece of drama they could. And look, I mean, we're all men, and it's like if somebody's, you know, you have a disagreement with somebody and he challenges you, something's going to happen. I mean, Paxson didn't punch him. Paxson grabbed his tie. So what? Fred, you grabbed his tie at work 100 times.
Mark, we're not always full about that. I think we're fair and impartial. We're fair and impartial. I wasn't happy when they let Korver go. I was very angry about that. I wasn't happy when we re-signed Kirk Heinrich. It's not like I'm going to praise every move they make.
Yes.
But overall, I think this management team has done an excellent job. And they
swayed on their side just because we agree with what they've done.
After going through the Kraus years, you know, basically out of the last 11 seasons, we've had one losing season. You can't find that in many other places. And everybody talks about San Antonio. San Antonio took Corey Joseph the pick before the Bulls took Jimmy Butler. So everybody makes mistakes. Nobody's perfect, you know, and the Bulls have done really good, I thought, drafting late. And, you know, been pretty good in signing free agents, guys like Korver to come in here and help the team improve, and all these guards we get off the scrap heap. And they've made a couple really good coaching hires in Skiles and Thibodeau.
Absolutely. You know, you look at a lot of these other situations around the league and what they're doing. I mean, do you know how much worse it could be? I mean, look at Sacramento.
Yeah.
Look at Sacramento.
Oh, my gosh. What a mess.
I will defend the Knicks, though. One thing I do want to say, I think they did about as good as you could possibly do in this past draft, where they were at. You took a risk. I think this kid looks pretty impressive to me. Have you guys seen this Porzingis at all? Grantland had a great special on him. If you get a chance, check it out on Grantland. Phenomenal special of him practicing at his pro day. Guy's 7-footer. I mean, he looks like very Dirk-ish to me, Dirk Nowitzki-ish to me. And then they got Grant, who I love, from Notre Dame by making that trade for Hardaway Jr., who can't hit a shot. So I think they made two really good moves on draft day, and I think they made their team much better. Let's say you.
I just want to say that. Go on, sorry.
I agree. I just think they're still getting burned by the Melo thing. I don't know if you guys know, they don't have a first-round pick next year.
I did not know that. Who's got their pick?
I didn't know that either.
I think it's from Denver, from the Melo trade, but then...
Oh, my God.
Denver has the rights to swap, which they I mean, they're both probably going to be pretty bad. So,
yep.
But either way, if they swap, I believe the Knicks pick goes to the Raptors. So,
oh my God! I think everybody's back.
I'm okay with that, though. At the time that they got Carmelo Anthony, nobody would say that that wasn't a good move when they got him. If this had to do with his re-signing, if you were giving up picks so that you could potentially re-sign him, then I'd be like, no. I mean, when they re-signed him, it didn't make any sense to me because they weren't good enough to be re-signing a player that cost that much. When they got him, I have no problem with it. You give up draft picks to get a player of that caliber, and he was one of the best players in the NBA.
Yeah, I mean, it's just funny to look back and think, you know, they were going to win all these games with Amari Stoudemire and Carmelo Anthony, and look what happened.
Sure.
I just,
you
like,
know, it doesn't always
like,
work out how you want, but if you make – my general rule of thumb is if management makes a decision that you agree with when they make the decision, A, you're a coward if you look back in hindsight 2 years later and say, oh, like when Ben Wallace got signed. Nobody didn't like that move when we signed him. It didn't work out. But you can't deny the fact that everybody was pretty pumped. We had the biggest free agent signing. And, yeah,
absolutely.
He was kind of on the downswing, but he won Defensive Player of the year before. I mean, nobody disliked that move. Nobody disliked the Carmelo move when they first got him. So – for that, I'm like, whatever. I mean, it didn't work out. I mean, it sucks for them that it didn't work out, but that's the nature of the league. That's the nature of sports.
And the thing about Paxson and Gar is when they have made mistakes with Tyrus Thomas, when they have made mistakes, you know, they've always almost made something out of it. They managed to get a future first rounder for Tyrus Thomas that I think ended up turning into
McDermott.
Yeah, so... You know, and jury's still out on him, but, you know, when you look at Noah, especially when you look at where they got Nico, where they got Taj, where they got Jimmy Butler, just those picks alone.
They took
Amir Sheik. Cephalosha is still in the league, still playing.
How about James Johnson even? James Johnson is starting. He may not have had his glory years with us, but he's starting on the Raptors.
Dang is still a member, you know, competing, you know, player in the league. They've done a really good job. Even Heinrich, you know, as much as I think the guy sucks, you know, I understand he's been around for a while and, you know, he's done some decent things in the league.
I read a report the other day where they did like a redraft of that draft class and Heinrich was in the same spot today as he was when he got drafted. So you can't complain about that. And Bleacher Report did a before the draft, they graded every GM in the league on their ability to draft, and they gave Gar Forman an A. And I don't blame them. Like, they were listing everything down.
Absolutely
like,
true.
He's an A. Yeah. And I'll be honest, I went through the list, and I didn't see another GM that had an A. So, you know, I don't know. Take a look. Maybe there was another one that had an A. But, no, I didn't see anyone else that had an A. They certainly were not just throwing these things out there. So we're not the only ones that think that they've done a hell of a job drafting, and that's the – frankly, I mean, like, that's the toughest thing, frankly. I mean, you have a lot of GMs that are just completely incompetent. The fact that they still get players is huge. That's a conversation in itself. So I want to, Andy, do you have any comments? Any more comments from your evening over there? Because I do want to at some point address that because that's a very interesting conversation.
You know, really, those were the main points that I had to make. They said a couple other things like they thought that Butler, Nico, and Snell, they all only developed because guys ahead of them got injured, which is another thing we've been saying.
Amen.
It's true.
I overheard Kukoc talking to someone else later in the evening, and I got the impression that Nico and Tibbs just aren't getting along, or that they didn't when they were in a player coach. Because, you know, Kukoc apparently has a relationship with Nico. So
makes sense. Yep.
Did they say anything about the relationship that Tony has with the organization right now?
Not really. I mean, I
think it's pretty positive, Mark.
He lives Highland Park, and I know he has some sort of relationship with Mirotić. That's all I know.
Interesting. Because I know that he was doing a camp today for the Bulls, and yeah, I know that he aligned himself a lot with the Bucks towards the end of his career, so I'm just curious if he's, you know, if at all he has any sort of relationship, because the Bulls seem to do a decent job of keeping past players, you know, in the circle of trust of the Bulls organization.
Right. Yeah, I don't know if he holds an official title of any sort.
Interesting. Was there anything else interesting that you got out of that day?
Yeah. You know, the last thing is just that they both were very adamant that they thought the Bulls had more than enough to win this year and that we should have beaten Cleveland.
So, Andy, you and I have been battle after battle with Karen and this other Chris on Twitter. I mean, it seems like this has gone on for about a month. Mark, you jumped in there at the end when I couldn't take it anymore. I just
it's gone on longer than this. Mid-season, he was sticking up for Heinrich when he was going 0-6 every night.
I know. Well, yeah, this guy had the nerve to defend Heinrich, and I'm like, I finally like destroyed every argument he had. You know, basically, oh, he's been. Okay. My favorite one was he rips on Snell. He goes, Snell will never be a rotation player on a contender. And I go, name the team that Turk Heinrich was a rotation player on that was a contender. And he's been on one team that won 50 games in his whole stinking career, and this guy spends half his day defending Turk Heinrich, and he makes a statement like that about
what us, right?
Starting his career.
What? Last year, right?
Well, yeah. The worst year of his career, he was not a contender. I felt the team was a contender last year, but this guy, Chris, was arguing that it wasn't a contender. In fact, his whole point was this team had no talent. It was all Thibodeau, which is just a complete asinine statement. Any U.S. 30 GMs in the league who had the most talent in the East, I think there's a good percentage that would say the Bulls had the most talent or one of the top two teams. They sure as hell had enough talent to beat Cleveland minus Love and minus Kyrie Irving.
Oh,
you know,
yeah, that's the problem. That's where things get sticky. And even though we didn't have Powell, and we could say that all day, obviously not having Powell hurt us a lot, but they didn't have anyone. They didn't have anyone. And you saw they were good. I mean, they put up a bit of a fight against the Golden State Warriors, who had an infinite depth. But we should have been able to take them. We still gave up. I don't know, whatever. I mean, people want to argue about Thibodeau until the end of time. That's fine. I just hope to God that we made the right coaching choice this time because that will allow us – this is an important time because that will allow us to start throwing in everybody's faces immediately. If we're not great next year, everyone's going to be like, well, Thibodeau, even if it has nothing to do with Thibodeau. So, you know, God willing, we have a good season next year and it'll just be like, what do you think now?
I hope we're not rejuvenate
an organization. Look at Golden State. Golden State – was never better than a 6 seed. The best record they ever had was winning 50 games the year before. I mean, that was their ceiling. They sound ironically a lot like the Chicago Bulls, but
they
in the
do.
West. Kerr comes in, and all of a sudden these guys love Kerr. They love playing for Kerr. He knows how to utilize these guys to their strengths, not just to some philosophy that he wants to impose on the team. This team won almost 20 games more. And when you go from 50 to 67 wins in the West, that is a huge jump. From the 6 seed to unanimously the best team in the league, no questions asked, in the West, it's just unfreaking real. And, I mean, that's what I'm hoping for with this team, that you have this rejuvenation where guys just want to play basketball again.
And you look at the jump that Green made. I kind of compare that to the jump that maybe a Nico could make or McDermott can make. And I hope – I would rather see the Bulls have 45, 46, 47 wins and go down a little bit. And I still think that your coach could do a better job because he's not going to play every game to win it. He's going to understand. So he's going to sacrifice some regular season games for the development of players that in the long term will yield a team more likely to win a title. That's a smart coach. To play every game like it's the seventh game of the finals is stupid. And that's what we have. So – you know, I don't care if we have a worse regular season. If it means that we've developed younger players and sacrificed wins, we'll be better off in the playoffs. So
I do
if we
win 50 games, I thought we tremendously underachieved this year, and I think most people do. This team in the East, no matter what, should be able to win 50 games next year, no matter what. I mean, even with the injuries that they had this year, it's not like when those injuries happened. They had a drop for like 2 weeks where they were just terrible. Besides that, for most of it, they weathered the storm all right, and it wasn't like they were that great when the injuries happened. They were still playing inconsistently. The Bulls should win 50 games in the East, no matter what. I don't care if they're – you could rest guys for games and play for the playoffs. That's fine with me, but they still should be able to win 50 games without a lot of effort because their talent level is so much higher than the rest of the East. It just is. And now you've
yeah,
got
but you can't predict
guys. Atlanta, Washington, they've lost guys already. They're not going to be as good.
Yeah. Mark, though, you can't predict season-ending injuries. We didn't have any season-ending injuries last year. Look what happened to Miami with Bosch. I mean, if you looked at Miami's roster, Bosch, Wade, Dang, and, you know, Whiteside comes out of the blue. I mean, that was definitely a playoff team. Not at the end of the season, though, based on injuries, right? I mean,
sure.
Miami's roster is really good. I especially with the draft pick, I think they're going to be a much better team. It's too simplistic to say, well, if the Bulls don't have 50 wins next year, it was a mistake to fire Thibodeau. That's so stupid. It's beyond belief. You know, they could have 44 wins and we could have a better coaching job from our coach. If it's developing talent and, you know, maybe we'll have a season-ending injury. God forbid, but it happens. Look at most of the teams in the league.
Yeah, I'm not taking that into consideration. Because, I mean, you don't know what's going to happen. Obviously, if a major player goes down, we can reevaluate the statement here. But, you know, I certainly think that we should be able to win as many, if not more, games next year, regardless of how the team is coached. I mean, it's just the talent level is just too high, and these sucks.
Go up and down the NBA rosters from Oklahoma City to Portland. A lot of teams had the Knicks, the Miami Heat. A lot of teams had season-ending injuries to rotation players. The Bulls did not have that last year.
Agreed. Agreed.
So let's get into the – you got a list now and wrap this up. We're already over, like, an hour. So let's do that because I'm almost out of juice on my phone too.
Sure. Well, real fast, just to circle this back here to the Kings thing that we were talking about here, I've never seen a team as dumb as this team in my life because, A, during the season, when they were hiring George Karl, they made it known that they were going to be getting rid of their coach. And I mean, like, they were interviewing George Karl as the season was still going. It was one of the most disrespectful jobs I've ever seen of going out and finding a new coach. And I think, was it Malone? Or was Malone already fired by the time they got Karl? Did they fire Malone, then get somebody else, then hire Karl?
No, Malone started the season, they're almost .500, and then he got fired. I'm sorry,
I believe
they're
a temporary coach in between, I believe.
Okay. So, I mean, it's very disrespectful to him, whatever. So, you talk to George Karl. George Karl, obviously, your vision is DeMarcus Cousins. We're building around him,
right?
Yada, yada. I thought it was Ty Corbin.
Ty Corbin.
So, you have
this
vision. You bring in George Karl, and then George Karl doesn't like DeMarcus Cousins, and now he's trying to get rid of DeMarcus Cousins. So, now management wants to get rid of George Karl. They're talking to John Calipari right now. That was in the paper today, and it's just like, oh, my God. Like, I mean, everything they're doing is just out in the public. I'm sure that, I mean, maybe you can save face with DeMarcus Cousins by getting rid of Karl, but you probably already pissed him off. So you've got some dead weight coach that's just a complete jackass, and you've got your best player doesn't even want to play on the team anymore. It's just what that team has done to just muck up their whole situation is one of the most incredible things I've ever seen in sports. It's unbelievable.
Well, I think the problem is I disagree with you. I think George Karl is a very good coach, and when DeMarcus Cousins is the centerpiece of your organization, you're going to have this because the guy's a clown. I see nothing but warning signs about DeMarcus Cousins. And I saw it this year when the Bulls, he dominated Joakim Noah in the game that Gasol was out. Later in the season, they come to Chicago, and the guy was acting like he didn't even want to be there. It was like a totally different player. Bulls totally dominated the Kings. I don't understand why people can't see this thing. Yes, he's got tons of talent. You know, you can look up and down the history of the NBA from Derek Coleman, up and down, the guys that had tons of talent, but didn't have the desire or just the attitude to win games. I think there's nothing but sirens going off when I look at DeMarcus Cousins. I wouldn't touch the guy. In fact, I heard the Lakers want to trade Russell for him potentially, and if I were the Kings, I'd make that move immediately. I just don't understand, you know. You've been around this guy. You think there's issues or problems? Come on.
Regardless of which, when George Karl came to that team, he knew that the team's vision was DeMarcus Cousins being your main guy. You signed under that pretense. So it's like, that's fine. Whatever you think about DeMarcus Cousins, whatever. If management says this is what our vision is and you go along with it, and then the minute that things start, you start mucking things up from the inside, that's on George Karl. George Karl, come on. I mean, that's just ridiculous. I don't agree with it at all. I think George Karl's a clown. This, to me, he should never have another job in the NBA. This should be it. I mean, after that, I don't care if you've had cancer. Get the hell out of here.
Well, and George Karl's won a lot more than Boogie Cousins. I think that will probably...
I don't care. He still signed with the team knowing what their vision was. Don't go to that team if you don't agree with the vision.
All right. What say you, Andy?
I think, you know, I think they should trade DeMarcus Cousins. I've never been a huge fan of the guy. I think he's a head case, and wherever he goes, he's never going to win, especially if he's the guy that you're paying, you know, max money to, and he's taking up a third of your cap space. You know, I don't know. I heard the rumblings that they're looking to get Coach Cal now, Calipari, over to the Kings, which would be so disgraceful to fire a coach after half a season.
I think that's the one move that might save. If you're going to insist on making Boogie Cousins your centerpiece, then you better get in the only guy who seemed to connect with them. And I am kind of a Calipari fan. I think that would work. So I would agree with that if they made that move. But if they're going to bring in, you know, Tom Thibodeau, forget it. I would love that. Oh, my God.
Oh, great. Whatever they do, you bring in another coach. That's four coaches in 1 year. That would be unfreaking believable. Four coaches in a year. That would be unbelievable. That's never happened before. That could never have happened before in the NBA. I'm sure it's never happened.
Because
it's only been one season and part of an off season. They haven't even played two seasons yet. And you're talking about four coaches here. So, all right, that's to the side. We do have breaking news right here. Draymond Green just signed a 5-year, $85 million deal. Fair deal?
Who didn't see that coming? I personally am not like the biggest Draymond Green fan. I think he's a good player, but you know, is that a max deal? Is that what he signed?
That's not
a max deal.
5-year, $85 million. I don't think is max. I would have to.
Okay.
It's not far off.
You got players that when they go ahead, Andy.
I think it was Chris Middleton that got 5 years for $70 million today.
Oh my God! It is almost max. That's $17 million a year.
I mean, you have to remember these are the new, you know, people are projecting once the cap goes up, you know, these contracts won't look as bad as they do today.
That's correct.
Everything that I've been seeing today is unbelievable. The Cleveland Cavaliers right now have 10 players under contract. They have $121 million in payroll right now with 10 guys under contract. They still have to sign three more. The record of all time is $130 million. That's the Nets of, I think, 2 years ago when they hit 130 and they sucked. But you saw today. They gave Amon Shumpert a four-year, $40 million contract. They just signed a max contract with Kevin Love, which was huge. They got Tristan Thompson was like, wasn't it, I think Tristan Thompson signed I think he signed for like $10 million a year. I think he signed for more. I thought he signed for like $50 million over 4 years. I think it was $50 million over four.
I can't believe these contracts. I thought Danny Green, you know, Danny Green is making over $10 million a year. And I don't know. I just got to get my head wrapped around how much these guys are making. Cause,
Jesus Christ.
You know, to me,
5 years, $80 million is what he got. That's like $16 million a year for Tristan Thompson.
For who?
Who did not start the first game of the playoffs against us, Tristan Thompson.
Yeah,
that's
this is insane, the amount of money these guys are getting. I just always felt that when you give a double-digit $10 million or more to a role player, you're really putting yourself in a situation you may regret down the road. I do realize the cap is going up. You know, seeing Danny Green, at least Danny Green shot 42% and he plays D, so these 3-and-D guys, I understand how valuable they are, but just to me, Draymond Green is never – you know, going to be like the number one player on the team. And if he is, then you're Sacramento or, you know, a horrible team. You know, everything that Draymond Green did great primarily was a result of the defensive attention. I'm talking offensively for Draymond Green. Was the defensive attention that, you know, Stephon Curry attracted. I think that's why he had such a successful season on the offensive end. Yeah, he's a great defender. I understand that. And he has value there. But, again, he almost went – you said he's making $17 million a year for Draymond Green.
Unbelievable.
I think that's
insane. I still think, you know what, any of these teams that were already capped out to begin with, it doesn't matter because you couldn't go out and get free agents anyway, so you got to keep your players at any cost. It doesn't matter. I mean,
exactly.
There's no other way to get talent than keeping your players, so I have no problem with what the Warriors or the Cavs did. I'm sure that other guys can look up and down the roster and be like, hey, I should be making as much as Draymond or more than Draymond, and it is what it is. I mean, this is what the salary cap situation is creating in the NBA right now. I don't mind as much with winning teams like that. But when you're talking about like the Phoenix Suns today signing Tyson Chandler for four years, fifty-two million over four, that I don't get, because it's like you already didn't make the playoffs. Tyson's not going to make you necessarily even a playoff team, and to be paying him, you know what, $12 million a year, seems pretty high when he doesn't really even have,
yeah.
I feel like, a true role on the team.
I tweeted this out today. The reason why the Bulls are good is for situations like this. They have Taj Gibson making 8.5, Paul Gasol making 7.4, and Nico Mirotic making 5.5 this next season. Those guys make less than Kobe Bryant does by himself. Kobe Bryant makes $25 million next season. When you're devoting, you know, $25 million or, you know, a quarter basically or more than that of your cap to a player who's injured all the time, who's, you know, was once great, but, you know, this is a ridiculous contract. And then you can contrast that with the Bulls, who are paying three guys, in my opinion, undervalued, right? Taj making 8.5. I think Taj, that's healthy, deserves more than that. No doubt Gasol deserves more than that. And Nico is definitely, you know, probably more than a $5.5 million player. So that's why you win. You know, that's how you win. You got to have contracts like that on your roster, especially with Rose making $20 million. And that's why I get a little concerned that, you know, obviously we had no choice with Butler, but, you know, I don't know if you guys look at it this way. I look at it this way. There's players that are max guys who are underpaid, like LeBron, right? You know, the guy, if it was a true no cap situation, I'm sure some team would be paying him $40 or $50 million. But then you have other guys that you're kind of like forced to give max deals. And I kind of view Jimmy in there. You know, I think he had one great season. You know, I thought the contract that hopefully he would have signed last year was probably a little bit more fair. He deserves it, right? He's a great kid. He works hard, plays both ways. But, you know, to me, if you have a lot of deals like this, you can put yourself in trouble.
I want to ask you guys something. I think Jimmy Butler, you could argue, is the best two-way guard in the league.
You could. I mean, if it's
for shooting, for shooting guards.
He could be.
For shooting guards.
I mean, it's just one, you know, I agree with Fred to the extent that it was only 1 year. If you look at these deals that guys are signing out there now, he deserved the deal. I have no issue with Jimmy Butler. You're probably right. He might be the best two-way two-guard in the league right now with what he did last season. It's always a risk when a guy plays like that in his contract year. God only knows what he's going to do over the next 5 years. You're asking him to do a lot considering what he's done over the last four. He wasn't this guy until this year. But, I mean, he had 1 year that was very special, and let's hope he can do it again. But I agree with you.
He'd be a top 10 player. Yeah. Go ahead, Mark. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Maybe he's not a top 10 player, but that's not what a max contract means these days. Dude, Amir Johnson got $12 million a year. Amir Johnson.
Yeah.
It just is what it is. Amir Johnson, 9 points a game, 6 rebounds, and he got $12 million a year from the Celtics. That's just unbelievable to me.
What besides James Harden, what other two guards would you rather have than Butler?
Well, for 1 year, let's just say 1 year, I still think Wade has a lot in the tank. You know, if I'm saying for just one season, I thought he played pretty well this year.
You're not going to get much out of that. I mean, I think you're going to get 55 games a year, and you're hoping he's healthy at the end of the season at this point.
I would probably agree with you. What about DeMar DeRozan, maybe?
I would take Butler over him in a heartbeat.
I would too.
Kawhi Leonard?
I would take Butler.
He's more of a small forward than a shooting guard.
I think they're very similar players.
They're very similar, though.
Two or three. I think Kawhi Leonard is a step. I mean, it's pretty close, but I think Kawhi Leonard is a little bit better.
They both got the same exact contract
today. I think that he's just overrated because he's on the Spurs. He's not the scorer that Jimmy was last year. He never has been.
I want to say Jimmy got to the line more than anyone last year besides Harden and maybe LeBron. He was up there.
He was right there. And, I mean, that's huge. I mean, the efficiency that he scored with last year, I don't think – if Jimmy Butler had been on the Spurs, it would have been a whole different situation in terms of, you know, how good they were. I mean, maybe they would have beaten the Clippers. I definitely think he's a step up. You might be right. I mean, he might be – the best two guard in the league. I mean, second best two guard
other
in the league.
Harden.
Behind Harden. Other than
Harden, the other guy, Klay Thompson's up there, obviously. I mean, he's...
Oh, absolutely. I forgot about him. Yeah, of course. He's definitely there, too.
He's definitely right there with him, in my opinion. I think I would give Butler the slight edge. I mean, the guy started LeBron and scored 20-some points a game for us. I mean, there's not many guys that can do that.
Yeah, though, to be fair, I mean, LeBron did not shoot well against the Golden State Warriors, and obviously his primary – it was a team defensive effort.
He had Iguodala
on
him. Probably the best job on him. But, I mean, there's a lot of guys – Iguodala is a good example of a guy I'd kind of put in the Butler category. He's more of like a 2/3. You can play both positions interchangeably. That's where the league is going, these guys that can, you know, switch and play both positions interchangeably. Butler's definitely near the head of that group. I'd still probably have Leonard ahead of him just a little bit. I think Leonard's a little younger, isn't he? Am I wrong on that? Maybe
they're drafted the same exact year, but I think Butler maybe was in college longer.
Jesus. Dembare Carroll got $15 million a year. Unbelievable. 4 years,
insane.
$60 million for the Raptors. You know, that's a team
that's
the Atlanta Hawks. They did keep Paul Millsap this year, though. I think he got max over 3 years, which I think is a ballsy move.
These guys are taking
short-term deals to try to go get long-term deals a couple years from now. Depending on who you are, that can be a really bad move, because unless you are, like, young in your prime and you know that 3 years from now you will be the player you were now and everyone's going to believe you'll be that player 5 years from now and you'll get that one more contract, fine. But there's no guarantees. And Paul Millsap, I mean, how young can he possibly be? He's been in the league for a long time.
Yeah, and that's what I said, too, when I saw these contracts going down. You know, everybody's got to realize this is Paul Gasol's last year at the Bulls. He's got a player option for next year at 7.7. You would have to be completely insane to take the in on a player option when you got guys like Carroll out there and other big men signing for $12, $15 million a year. I mean, there's no doubt Paul Gasol, if he has another year like he did last year, if he opts out and does not take that player option, somebody's going to give him a 2-year deal at like 15 to 20 a year.
I don't know, though, man, because look at Paul Pierce. Paul Pierce today signed a 3-year deal at $10 million total. And it's, I mean,
Mark,
who,
the cap goes up. The cap goes up next year. I guarantee.
But then why did a guy like Pierce, age takes it all down. Even if it's like a 1-year deal, age takes it down. Paul Pierce meant more to the Wizards than anybody besides John Wall this year. Anybody. And he signed a 3-year, $10 million deal. I mean, at 37,
Gasol,
I don't think. Go on.
Go ahead, Andy. If Gasol was a free agent right now, today, how much do you think he would get? I think he would get a heck of a lot more than what he did.
Amen.
Maybe
But there's a big difference. Guy. There's a big difference between now. And I mean, because now next year he's 34 this year, so now he's 35 going into this season, 36 next year. That's a big difference. I mean, it's just like you're right. If he was a free agent right now with how he played, and we'll see how he does this year. If he does just as good,
not if it's a
2-year argument, but
if he's all NBA again and he makes the All-Star team, you're just way off on this. He'll get a 2-year, $40 million deal, or not 40, but
yeah.
$20 million, somewhere probably about 30 to 40 million. Yeah. I think he would. With cap space, the Knicks would love to have a leader in there who could show the young guys how to behave, how to win, you know, do the things that it takes to win. I could see a team absolutely signing a 2-year deal with him for mucho dinero.
Plus, and I believe, Fred, you've said this before, that his game ages well, like much like Tim Duncan's does.
Absolutely true. Yep. Look what he does, Mark. He passes well. He posts up well. I mean, those things are going to fall. It's not like his game is in the air, you know?
Right.
It's about hitting shots as a big man and everything else he does. Everything else, in my opinion, he played pretty much like he's done his whole career on the defensive end. It's just that, you know, in Thibodeau's system, your bigs are expected to guard, you know, like 30 feet out, which is absolutely insane for a guy like Gasol. So...
Absolutely.
I mean, a few other big deals of today. Brooke Lopez, Thaddeus Young staying with the Nets. Thaddeus Young, 4 years, $50 million. Brooke Lopez, max, 3 years, $60 million.
What a Brandon Knight kit.
$70 million. 5 years, $70 million.
I really like
that. 5-year, $90 million for Gordon Dragic. Jesus.
for Brandon Knight, 5 years, $70 million.
That's a good deal. I think Brandon Knight's a really good player. I thought he had a great year last year, underrated year. And he got better every year. He's a good ball player, man. I really did. I thought it was insane for Milwaukee to let him go. When you think about it, they basically could have got him for the same thing that they signed Middleton, right? I mean,
yeah.
I don't know. I'd probably rather have Knight than Middleton. But Middleton's a good player, don't get me wrong.
Well, they got Carter Williams in that deal, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Yeah.
It was a three-way trade with Phoenix, right? How did that work? I can't recall. I don't remember
how
that went down.
I don't know
Phoenix,
what the Sixers got
Phoenix,
out of it. But.
Miami and the Sixers. And the Sixers got, I don't remember. I thought that they got, like, picks and stuff. I think they got somebody and they cut them, and I can't remember who it was. But, yeah, I don't think the Sixers. I think that they got, like, young prospects or draft picks.
It may have
what
actually
some
been
other...
a four-way deal because didn't the someone got the
Suns were involved.
The Rockets maybe got KJ McDaniels or someone like that. I don't remember.
Yes, you're right. No, didn't he go to? Wasn't he on the Sixers before, and then he went to?
He was on the Sixers, and then he went to the Rockets somehow. Maybe that was a separate deal, but
okay. So here it is, guys. I just called it up while I was waiting. It was Brandon Knight to the Suns, Michael Carter Williams to Bucks in trade. Milwaukee Bucks traded guard Brandon Knight to the Suns and received guard Michael Carter Williams from the 76ers and center forward Miles Plumlee and guard Tyler Ennis from the Suns. So it was basically a three-way trade. As part of the deal, the Sixers acquired a protected 2015 first-round pick from the Suns via the Lakers. The pick is protected 1 through 5 in 2015, 1 through 3 in 2016 and 2017, and unprotected in 2018.
Huh.
Knight will help replace traded Goran Dragic for the Suns. He is bigger combo guard, capable of playing off the ball. Was nearly an all-star as key offensive player for the Bucks this year.
What do you guys think? Sorry.
No, go ahead.
What are you guys thinking about the Bulls are supposedly interested in Rodney Stuckey?
Yeah, I saw that. I was shocked to see it because, to me, he's not the kind of guy who fits in the Bulls' mold. I always couldn't stand his game. You know, like he's kind of like, to me, like a really poor, destitute, homeless Ben Gordon, homeless man's Ben Gordon. You know, like
yeah.
As far as like just throwing up shots, but not at a good percentage, not a lot of range. I guess he would be okay coming off the bench. You know what? It would probably fit in with the group of guards that we had off the scrap heap with Brooks, you know, and DJ Augustin and Nate Robinson. What do you think, Mark?
I mean, I think he's better than they are. Look, he's been a starter with a lot. I think he's better than any of them are. I mean, look, he shot poorly. He shot like 45% last year. He shot almost 40% from three. I mean, that's pretty good.
The guy's
6'5 as well, if I'm correct.
No, he's not.
Yes, he is. 6'5. Good call.
Rodney
Stuckey 29 years
is 6'5. There's no way Rodney Stuckey is 6'5.
I'm all for it, man. I mean, I think that he could be I think what we need is kind of a combo guy, a guy that can play the two and can play the point. You know, somebody that could potentially play both, but somebody that you can rely on to score. Aaron Brooks he would fall to the wayside during big moments, especially during the playoffs. He really sucked. 44% last year, 39% from three. I have no problem with that coming to the team. 81% free throw shooter, fine. Averaged 3.1.
He shot
26 minutes a game. He only averaged 26 minutes a game last year.
Mark, he shot 39%
from three. 39%
from
three. That's not bad. 44
overall. No, it's not. It's not 41. No, I mean that's what you told me. I almost fell off a chair.
No, I said he almost shot 40. He almost shot 40 from three, is what I said. 40.
Oh well, that's like Tony Snell range. But his career, what's his career to be? 30.5. So,
well, yeah, but let's just see. Okay, but that could also be that, you know, maybe it's gone up a little bit in the last year. So yeah, he was an awful 3-point shooter for most of his career. So, but he's brought it up tremendously over the last few years. So last year was a career year, percentage wise. So yeah, he shot career highs last year in both field goal percentage and 3-point percentage.
to me, he seems like a guy that, you know, in large doses, not very good like he was with Detroit, but maybe they put him in the right position with the right players around him, he can be good in short doses.
Okay,
I
knew
agree
I
with you. I think that he's somebody I think that he would be the best backup guard that we have had, you know, in this whole
rotation. He's been in the league since 2007. I'm going to read you his 3-point percentages in the league. Here we go. 18%, 29, 22, 28, 31, 30, 27, 39. One of these.
Look at the fact, though. He never averaged more, and he used to average way more minutes than he averaged last year. He never took more than 2 threes a game other than in 12-13 with the Pistons. Until last year, in 26 minutes, he was averaging 2 threes a game. So he was averaging the second most threes that he's had in his entire career last year in only 26 minutes a game.
I don't think I've ever seen that. I can't recall ever seeing a player be in the league as many years as him have such an awful 3-point percentage for – virtually every year of his career, and then have that outlier at 39%, which is absolutely solid. You're absolutely right. But
yeah, but think
I'm
about the
saying,
Pistons, man. The years that he were there, there was nobody on the Pistons. And it's like, fine, Indiana is a team that can move the ball around, that he's not going to be the focal point. Here he won't be the focal point. You're going to put Rodney Stuckey, a guy that had to be the man on Detroit for a couple of those years. He was like their primary scorer for a couple of the years. I mean, and then the other years he was one of their top scorers. I mean, not, you put him
God,
on Indiana.
God, is that awful.
He wasn't, yeah, exactly. You put people in positions where they can't succeed, their numbers go down tremendously. Guys like Ben Gordon, their numbers go down. I mean, Stuckey coming off of a career year on a team where he was able to play within a system, come to this team. I mean, Indiana last season, he obviously had a bigger role because you had Paul George out. You come to this team, you're going to be wide open taking those shots.
Don't ever compare Ben Gordon to Rodney Stuckey. Ben Gordon averaged 20 points per game for two winning teams. He never shot below 40% from three. Ben Gordon is 10 times a shooter and player that Rodney Stuckey is.
I can't stand the people who say, you know, Ben Gordon was such a detriment to the Bulls, you know, those years. And
those people are moron.
We wouldn't have been in the games without him.
It's unbelievable.
I agree.
And, you know what? It's totally unfailing. Those people are massive Heinrich lovers.
Who
always sent
Thor on that team?
And, you know, he was the only guy ever double teamed. I have quotes from Skyle saying, you know, if we're lucky enough to have a guard double team 25 feet out, the other guy's got to step up and make a shot. He averaged 20 points per game, which is hard to do in the NBA, twice for two playoff teams. There's no doubt he was a sixth man of the year. He shot 40% from three. Pretty much every year of his career, I think outside of his first season here, the guy was a phenomenal player for us all the way up until the end. And for people to defame him and say he wasn't good for the Bulls, they're just first-class morons. They don't understand basketball, and they weren't watching the games, and they only pay attention to, well, he doesn't play any defense. You know, that stupid, idiotic Chicago mantra that only players who play defense are good players. There's two sides to the freaking basketball. Guys who score are valuable, too. You know, I can't take it anymore. If I have to go back to those days of these idiots, mouth-breathing idiots, to tell me that Ben Gordon sucked for the Bulls, they're totally wrong, and without him, we would have never made the playoffs.
How about this right now?
The fourth quarters of him were great.
And not only that, he was extremely durable for us. He didn't get hurt until he left. And in that first season, he got hurt with Detroit. And he was never the same after that injury. If you go back and look at his stats, the first 2 weeks he was with Detroit, after that big contract, he was phenomenal. And then he got hurt with that ankle injury. He has never been the same since then. So, you know, you're in a bad situation there. But for people not to realize how great he was, it really leaves a bad taste in my mouth. It really bothers me.
Absolutely.
Let me say this, though. I mean, his field goal percentages did not – I mean, his minutes dropped. That's the issue. I mean, his numbers did not drop tremendously. I mean, last year he shot – about 44%, shot 36% from three, which for him is a little bit down, considering in Chicago he only shot over 40.
What are we talking about signing Ben Gordon, who was just cut by Orlando?
That's what I was going to say. Would you rather have Rodney Stuckey or Ben Gordon?
Ben Gordon. Easily.
Rodney Stuckey. At this point, 32-year-old Ben Gordon versus 29-year-old Rodney Stuckey, I'm taking Stuckey. What do you think, Andy?
Yeah, I mean, I love Ben Gordon as much as anyone, but, I mean, Ben Gordon nowadays, I mean, I can't say I've watched a lot of Magic basketball in the last few years, but, I mean, I'm sure Stuckey's probably better at this point in their careers.
No, I still believe in Ben. But
I'd love it if we brought him back. Hey, if we brought him back, I'd be doing cartwheels. But in terms of making a team that we think can win the finals, I think you need a guy that can potentially make more of an impact on the game. Ben Gordon's 32 years old. I mean, a lot of guys are out of
the league. I just trust Ben Gordon. Whatever role this guy's going to be, he better hit the three. And I trust Ben Gordon hit the three more than Rodney Stuckey. Even last year, I think Gordon, he shot in a bad year, 38% from three. Something 36. Like that. I could be wrong. Oh, well. I'm off by a few percentage points.
Except Kurt's taking a spot up on the roster right now. So
I know. That son of a bitch taking the player option still bothers me. He couldn't have done the moral thing and just said, you know what, it's time to hang it up. I sucked last year. You know, let me go off into the sunset with my millions that the Bulls have paid me. No, I need to, you know, take the 2.8 player option. Hey, I can't fault him for it. I just hope I know Hoiberg will be smart enough to keep his ass on the bench and let him be hold the clipboard or better yet, you know, wear the Benny the Bull costume and entertain.
Yeah, I want to hear what you guys think about Etuan Moore. I thought he should have been playing ahead of Kirk all year, to be perfectly honest.
I agree with you 100%. I don't think Etuan proved enough last year where I'd be like, you know, he's this or he's that, but he certainly showed that he was better than Kirk Heinrich, and he's a big point guard, too. I don't understand why he didn't play more, but, I mean, I do understand because it's Tom Thibodeau, but you can make that argument for so many guys on the team. I mean, remember, Fred, when we went to that game against Memphis, and Tony Snell was just going off, and then they benched him, and it just completely changed it just changed everything. The Memphis just came back, like, immediately. We put Snell back in the game, and he's completely cold at that point. It was just like, why did you take Snell out when he had just hit, like, six threes in a row? I mean, he was just rocking. Go on.
That's also when he brought in the sixth person onto the court, Thibodeau.
Exactly. He got the key there. No, nobody ever brings that up. The Thibodeau lovers never bring that one up. One of the dumbest things I've ever seen in a basketball game, sending out six guys out of a timeout for a technical with 2 minutes left when it's a one-possession game. But, they'll jump all the well. I mean, I guess one was in the playoffs and one wasn't. But, you know, I do agree with you. Like, Etuan Moore, I felt should have been playing more than Kirk. But, honestly, I know guys at the local Y who I felt would probably – I honestly would rather see Doug Tonis shoot three-pointers for the Bulls than Kirk Heinrich this year. And I swear to God, I am 100% sure. I would have more faith in Doug Tonis nailing three-pointers than I would in Kirk Heinrich. I am completely honest in that.
When Hoiberg was hired, I remember he, in his interview, he mentioned every single person on the Bulls roster except for Kirk.
Oh, God love Fred. I mean, right there, alone, that move alone. I mean, if that was typical, he'd wax poetic for 5 minutes about what all the stuff that Kirk does that no one else in the planet could see. And that move alone, just totally blown, you know, not even mentioning Kirk, is enough for me to love Fred Hoiberg. I'd give him.
Could he be a worse fit for Hoiberg's offense?
I'm sure, yeah.
Kirk?
It sounds like he is.
Yeah,
but the fact is that if you can bury him,
role?
If you get a guy like Stuckey, you could bury him and have him be so deep. Because he could have the role of, like, what Etuan Moore had. I mean, he doesn't – just because he picked up that option, he's not making that much money. He doesn't need to play. I mean, you have Allen on the team. But you got to sometimes just eat it. I mean, he's not making that much. You could just say, whatever. He's taking up a spot on the roster. No big deal. We've got these other guys that are going to be playing above him. And the fact is that if he's the 14th, 15th guy on the roster, fine. 13th even. Whatever. As long as he doesn't have he should be averaging 3 minutes a game. Whereas, you know, there's some games you got to use him because he got an injury or something like that, but he should not be part of the regular rotation. As long as he's not part of the regular rotation, I don't care that he's on the bench. I don't care.
His role should be getting donuts for the guys, locking up the Advocate Center when all the lights are off. He should lock it up. He shouldn't have a role that involves shooting a basketball and dribbling on an NBA court. The guy sucks. I don't understand why this is so hard. He shot 37%. His percentages for the last 3 years, he's been under 40% for 3 years in a row. Any other player in the NBA with that kind of – who's played as much as he has, he had a PER less than 7, would be out of the league. The only reason he's still in the freaking league is because his name is Kirk Heinrich, and he went to the University of Kansas, where everybody from Kansas gets 18 chances despite trying to prove to everybody that they suck. From Rafe LaFrenz all the way down to that stinking university's overrated players they brought out to this, besides Paul Pierce and you know, Wilt Chamberlain, maybe a few others. But you could go up and down the history of Kansas, and there's nothing but bust after bust after bust. And to me, the shining light is Kirk Heinrich. Guy should not be in the league anymore. End of story. So we gave him a contract. We'll have to deal with it.
Can I get your take on something?
Sure.
Yeah, sure.
It's just funny to look back on the playoffs and, you know, if a couple of things go different, how different our conversation would be right now. Do you think if they catch the David Blatt trying to call timeout and the Bulls end up winning that game and we go up 3-1, do you think we finish off that series?
Yes, and I think David Blatt gets fired.
I'd say no. I don't think so.
You think they would have won 3 in a row?
Well, to me, the biggest thing is that as soon as Gasol got hurt, to me, the series is basically over. You look at that game where Blatt called the timeout. Every player, for the most part, on Cleveland played as bad as you possibly can play. LeBron had a horrible game. I mean, I couldn't believe how bad they played that game. You will not ever get that example again, and they still managed to lose it. So, and it was clear the next three games, I mean, the Bulls were never really close. I mean, you could say, well, they had a, you know, one possession game, but they got dominated for the vast majority of that game five.
Yeah.
And game six was a disgrace, you know. I mean, I think, and did you really feel after losing games four, five in the fashion they lost it, where they were dominated for most of the game, game six, which wasn't even close, that we would go back to Cleveland and expect the Bulls to win? I don't feel that way, unless somehow Gasol came back. I thought Gasol was the big, you know, big reason we won game one. I thought he was a big reason that, you know, we won game three, too, because he played a good portion of that game. But we're not even guaranteed, though, a winning game four to get that timeout. That's another thing that people forget, right?
Wouldn't we have gotten free throws right there for that?
Yeah, but I think
– I forgot what the score was. I don't know if we were tied or down by one or up by one. We weren't up. We were at – I think it was tied.
Yes, it was tied. So if he had gotten called on that, we would have had two free throws.
And then LeBron hit the shot right after that, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
We would have had two free throws
with
no time left. It would have been – and I don't believe that they had – I don't believe they had any timeouts left either.
Well, then they were reviewing.
Wait a second.
Something, weren't they?
I think you're wrong here. I think you're wrong here. Correct me if I'm wrong. What happened was it was a tie game when Blatt started calling timeout, and they had a turnover when LeBron was called for an offensive foul for running over Dunleavy right immediately after that. Then Rose on the next possession hit the layup to give us the 2-point lead. Then on the last possession of the game, he hit the three. If memory serves me correct.
No, I think this is what happened. Rose hit the two to tie it, and then Blatt tried to call it, but Tyronn Lue stopped it. And then the play happened, but it went out of bounds, and it was a questionable whether it went off one team or the other. So they reviewed it, and while they were reviewing it, Blatt was drawing the play, and that's when LeBron said, just give me the ball.
Yes.
I think you're right. Yeah, you're right. All right, you're right. You just got it. I think you – hit it right there. Yeah, good point. But, well, you know, so what's – all right, okay, so what you're saying is they were down when he tried to call timeout.
Yeah, you know, it's crazy. That series
– everybody's screaming at us, I know, right now.
We were one Rose shot away from winning the first game and then getting swept, and we also were one LeBron shot from being up 3-1, and who knows what happens after that. It's crazy to think about.
It is.
It is.
And, you know,
it is. And that was really our chance to do it. I mean, you know, Powell got injured.
To me, though.
So I guess we'll see, you know, kind of how it turns out with this, you know, with this upcoming season. Hopefully we're healthy in the playoffs. But I certainly felt like, you know, the blood was on the ground last year and we had the chance to really capitalize. But I just never felt like we were a team that was in it for the long haul last year. I mean, it just seemed like there was too much drama surrounding the team, and it was all surrounding the coach. And I've just never seen anything like it. I've never seen a team in the playoffs have a coach that was really attracting this much attention. Where I mean, it's just it never happens. The coach is normally not the guy that is, you know, the drama of the team. But I just didn't see when you had a coach
feel...
with a foot, one foot out the door, how you're going to win a playoff, you know, major playoff series, biggest playoff series since Jordan, when you already got it, when you have a coach with one foot out the door.
I will see a couple things. Number one, Thibodeau will never have a team more talented than the team he had in 2011 and this year and 2012, no matter where he goes to coach. I think our best chance to win was that 2012 team where, unfortunately, Rose got hurt. I mean, what if he never got hurt? To me, that's the big what if. The Bulls looked so good in that game. And, yeah, you know, they really had a team that was primed. And, you know, Rip Hamilton was the shooting guard, which is a massive upgrade on, you know, on Keith Bogans. Yeah, and but if you go back to me, it looks like the closest that Eastern Conference Finals in that first year, you know, people always say, oh, the Heat blew us out. Those games were extremely close. And those games I felt like could have gone either way. People forget Rose had – those were overtime games we had in Miami. Rose had the ball with a tie game. And, you know, he basically couldn't get a shot off. And the play calling in those games, to me, that's where Thibodeau really failed was, here, you just give the ball to Rose and have him win the game. And you got LeBron and Wade, two of the best perimeter defenders in the NBA, double-teaming him. And you couldn't come up with something better. You know, so I really thought, especially Game 5, I will never forgive Thibodeau for. Anybody wants to see a disgraceful loss, Game 5, the one when we got lost to the Heat, we had a double-digit lead with basically 3 minutes left. And that yep. moron has on the court to close it up. He's got Brewer, who can't hit a three. You got Big Sexy, you know, Kurt Thomas out there. Kurt Thomas, Dang, Taj, and Rose. And Rose is, he just, every time down, Rose was playing off the ball. He actually, Brewer playing the point. And he gets the ball. He's immediately double teamed. And he's got nowhere to go. They had five guys in the paint. There was nothing he could do. And every time they'd stop him, and then basket for the Heat. Stop him, basket for the Heat. Inexcusable to lose that game. All he had to do was put in Korver in that situation to spread the floor, and they would have won that game. They would have scored enough to win it. But no, he had to play defense first, and they lost. So, inexcusable. I thought that series was a lot closer than you thought. And people forget, too, that the Heat got destroyed in the finals. You know, so they got killed by Dallas in five games. So, it wasn't like that team was unbeatable. They should have won that one.
Yep.
But, good point. What might have been, you know?
Yeah, I got another thing I want to bounce off you guys, but Tim Legler brought this up. I want to hear what you guys think. You know, he brought up the fact that with Kyrie and Love both out, that forced them to play Dellavedova and, Tristan Thompson.
Shumpert, too.
If you look at how much better defensively they are with those guys in instead of Love and Kyrie, I mean, I'm not saying they're better with those other guys in, but there was an added bonus, you know, to them. At least one half of the court, they were 10 times better without those two stars.
I do agree with that. On defense, they were better, but it's still hard to say to me, are they a better team overall? So, Mark, we talked about this in the Bulls series, because you saw in the games that Kyrie Irving missed. I mean, they didn't even miss a beat. We got destroyed. Kyrie Irving, when he was out there in Game 6, he missed, you know, basically the whole second half. I mean, that's when they killed us, when he was out. So, I mean, they definitely were infinitely better defensively. They kind of mucked it all up defensively, and then just LeBron, everything works through him. Yeah, I do kind of agree with that. You know, the question is, though, you don't really know the delta, right? You know, obviously Kevin Love is much better and spread in the floor. I thought that was a big thing for them to lose him for the Bulls. Everything's matchups, right? And losing Love gave the Bulls a much better shot because it, you know, the big men for the Bulls didn't really have to go out as far. They could kind of clog the lane on LeBron. And I think it's part of the reason LeBron shot so poorly in that series.
Uh-huh.
So the Bulls were just able to pack it in. And but they hit enough, right? You know, I mean, J.R. Smith and all of them hit enough to win it. And they were much better defensively, where we scored under 75 points in the deciding game. It's disgraceful.
Yeah, I mean, I just wonder, you know, with Kevin Love in there,
for people who watched them during the season, they said he was just a glorified spot-up shooter. And I just wonder, you know, if, maybe if Tristan Thompson's not in there instead, I don't know. Because I felt their shooters that they did have in were phenomenal. They were hitting everything. And they were probably the biggest reason we lost, because they were hitting their threes.
Well, everybody's been giving mucho love to Tristan Thompson. And, you know, he's an active player. He deserves some, you know, commendation for what he does. But there's no way that Tristan Thompson and any other team would be even close to the player he is, or putting up the numbers he is, if he wasn't on LeBron James, wasn't playing with LeBron James. Because what does Tristan Thompson do especially well? Offensive rebound. Well, that's all LeBron. If you're a big man playing against LeBron James, you're constantly shadowing or looking at him and trying to go over to help. You cannot get a body on Tristan Thompson and stop a penetration from LeBron James and do both equally well. It's impossible. So Thompson was constantly had the advantage of having his man, who was responsible for him, coming off or at least paying attention to what LeBron was doing, and even allowing that little space that was enough for him to get to the rim and get an offensive rebound. So I know everybody just waxes poetic about the talents of Tristan Thompson, but to me, the guy, if he was on the Bulls, or he'd just be, you know, he'd be another player, right? He's not,
right.
Everything he does is because of the greatness of LeBron James, to me. You know, I mean, I wouldn't say everything, but a large percentage of the offensive rebounds he gets are due to him.
Yeah, I agree. I mean,
Mark.
Another one.
Mark, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. I agree. So, I mean, I didn't chime in. I agree with everything you said, Fred. It was rare.
Another what if, you know, if Joakim Noah is even half the player he was from the year before, I'd love to see what would happen.
Yeah, you know, it'll be interesting this year, because I feel like if you manage Joakim's minutes, that he should be able to have it in him to be good for spurts. I mean, we'll see what happens this year, but
I agree with that, Mark.
Was a good sample size, because I just feel like when you have a coach with one foot out the door, it must change the mentality of the team. There's no way that this team is as driven as they should be when your leader has one foot out the door, which he had the whole freaking year. I mean, he was this major distraction all year. I want to see what we're going to do now. Now that you've got somebody who, you know, some new fresh blood into this, and you've got this Gargamel of guys out of the door, it's going to be interesting to see what's going to happen. But I just by the middle of the series last year, against the Cavs, I was kind of just like, I was hopeful that something would surprise me, but I just didn't think that there was anything we could do that was going to make us win, because your coach was already, he was on his way out.
You know, I thought Joakim started the year obviously hurt, obviously a shadow of himself, horrendous. As the season wore on, like January, February, March, maybe that time frame, I thought he started to at least approach defensively, you know, some of the good things that he does, being active. He clearly didn't have, to me, the two biggest differences with Noah this year were he didn't have the lift on the offensive boards that he used to. And he should have had a ton of offensive boards this year. Gasol demanded so much attention, brought so many big men out on the perimeter that Noah should just cleaned house on the offensive boards. He didn't do it. How many times do you guys remember in the past Noah getting offensive board, you know, and dunking or laying it in and screaming, you know? How many times did we see that this year? Rarely ever.
Ever.
That is
never.
Completely due to his lack of lift and lack of, you know, just his physical deterioration. And number two, the far more disturbing thing, is the guy just fell apart completely as an outside shooter and a free throw shooter, to the point that it was scary that I don't recall him making a shot outside of the paint for almost the entire second half of the season. And that was something he was at least able to do sometimes with regularity, to at least be a threat. All right, I got to come out and guard this guy. And to be the smart teams like the Spurs, the Cleveland, they just said, hey, we're not even going to bother to guard you out there. You can do all your, you know, pick and rolls, everything you want to do. We'll just wait here underneath the rim and let you do all your nonsense, because you're not going to hurt us out there. But to the point it was embarrassing. I mean, the guy was passing up five-footers, kicking it out to guys at the three-point line for contested shots. And then his free-throw shooting was – this is a guy who's a 70% free-throw shooter his whole career, and all of a sudden he's shooting 1 out of 10 0-14 or 12 in the playoffs. I had never seen anything like it, never. And he's got to get that fixed. That's the number one thing to me is live in the gym and learn how to hit a jumper from 15 feet or get back your confidence. I don't know what it was. I think he may have been, had his confidence shattered, but he's got to get that back.
Yeah, I also wonder if they decide to trade him either in this offseason or maybe at the trade deadline next year, how that'll affect the locker room.
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't see that happening. I just think the team is too in love with him, and you know, I do kind of view him as a leader, obviously.
Yep.
Despite what Weddington said, I still consider him to be kind of like an important guy in the team. I'd be shocked if that happened. The only way that would happen is if we had just a horrendous season, you know, where injuries or whatever just hit us and we were 500 or below. I could see us, okay, we're going to rebuild around Jimmy, Derek, and Nico, you know? That's probably how I could
see that. I mean, I think Jimmy and Nico are our future. If you really think about it, our long-term future.
I think Rose is going to be a big part of our long-term future. He's only 26. I mean, I don't know. I saw enough this year to make me think that Rose with an off-season, give him an off-season, God willing he comes back and he's healthy last year or next year. I mean, I don't believe that this year's injury was a byproduct of last year. I don't believe that this was like a new thing. It was a byproduct of a poor decision that he made in the previous season. And I feel like at this point, I think I'm not – that worried about Rose. I thought he showed me enough considering how little he played. I mean, you consider Jordan. When Jordan didn't play basketball for 2 years, how he looked when he came back. It's like Rose didn't play for 3 years at all. And, I mean, he's coming off of an injury. We have to learn how to trust your body again. I thought he did all right. It's like, I mean, give him an off.
He did great in the playoffs.
Considering he was a little inconsistent, but whatever. I mean, who wouldn't be who missed that much time? Nobody. Everybody wants to compare him to Derrick Rose when he won the MVP, and that's just not fair. And it's like, give him an off season. Give him an off season. Let's see what he does this year, because I really think that coming into next year, you could see a different Derrick Rose now that he's – I'm sure that it's given him a lot of confidence. I'm sure that he's learned to tune everybody out and just play his game.
And I know I'm the only guy, you know, probably in this entire state, maybe in the country, who still believes in Doug McDermott. But I really believe the guy, if he's given a chance, you don't lose shooting ability. If he has a coach who doesn't bring him in the middle of the second quarter with, next to Snell and, other rookies or Nico and just says, brings him in there in the first quarter when he's somewhat warm, gives him an opportunity, puts him in a position to succeed and doesn't send him to the bench the first time he makes a defensive error. I think you're going to see the guy thrive and become and really become a weapon. Unleash. You can see Fred unleash this guy. And I think he's going to be something special, but I know I'm in the minority here, like the minority of one.
I agree with you. Absolutely.
All right. We got two. What do you say, Mark? Three? I doubt it.
Repeat it one more time. Sorry.
I'm not saying it again. No, just saying I think McDermott's going to be good. I really do.
I'm going to say this. Uh-oh. Regardless of whether he's good or whether he's not good, there was not a – McDermott didn't play. And when he played, he had such a short leash that it's got to mess with your mind. Nothing that McDermott did last year made me think really anything about what his long-term prospects are. So do I think he's going to be great? I have no idea. I mean, we haven't really seen him play in the NBA yet. So I have no issues with Doug McDermott. I'm excited to see what he could potentially do. I thought that when he played in the little minutes that he played in at the way end of the season, his field goal percentage was pretty damn good from what I remember.
I thought he had some really good moments there where he had like 10 points in 5 minutes. It seemed like
Indiana, I believe he had 16 minutes and 16 points or something like that.
Yeah.
And it's like call it garbage
that.
Minutes or whatever you want to call it, but the fact of the matter is this guy never played, and he was constantly just – he never knew his role, and he never knew when he was going to get pulled again. Can you imagine what that pressure must do to you when you're a shooter, when you're not taking high-percentage shots? It's got to really screw with you.
Absolutely. Yeah, you didn't have the coach to handle him. You had the exact opposite of how he should be handled. That's how Thibodeau did it. He had plenty of kid gloves for Heinrich, but for McDermott, he was a complete jackass. So, hey, you know what? He's gone. I'm not going to let him ruin my evenings anymore. He's gone. He can go on to whatever he does, eat pizza, wear Adidas sweatsuits, and be a dick.
Hey, in March, McDermott, no, it was in February.
Watch
in
film.
February, he shot 67% field goal percentage, and he shot 100% from three. I mean, limited attempts, but still.
Amen. Guys, I got to get to bed. So we've been out here, what, 2 hours?
You were going on 2 hours there. If we go another 12 minutes, this could be the longest podcast in history.
You better
Matt, real quick.
This nap. Yo,
real
sure.
quick. It was at Indiana. He played 16 minutes. He was 8 of 17, and he had 16 points that game. That was in March.
I bet you the next three games, the four games, he probably didn't even play 5 minutes.
No.
He
one, two, three games after that, he played 10 minutes against Philadelphia, 3 for 7, and then against Charlotte, 4 for 6. So really, you know, not that bad. Why did his numbers come down so much then? Because he only shot 35% for the month. It's because he had a crappy game against Toronto, 1 for 3, 33%. Oh, no, because he went 0 for 3 against Oklahoma City and 0 for 5 against Washington early on, and then he seemed to find a stroke against the Indiana Pacers where he went 8 for 17. But, again, I mean, you're talking
but
about, look at the beginning of that month. He didn't play at all against the Clippers, the first game of the month. Then 15 minutes, 8 minutes, 16, 12, 5, 10, 22, 5, 7, 4, 2, 0, 0, 0. I mean, he's all over the place.
Tibbs is such a jerk. I mean, honestly,
right?
Yeah, 8 of 17 in that game. What were his minutes in the next five games? Could you read them off?
The 8 of 17 game was followed by 12 minutes,
minutes?
5 minutes, 10 minutes, 12 minutes, 5, 7, 4, 2, 0, 0, 0. So he had a five-minute game
what
immediately following that, and then 10 minutes against the Philadelphia 76ers. And I get it. The 76ers are a hell of a team, so the last thing you'd want to do is be playing a rookie against the 76ers.
Yeah, exactly. Unbelievable.
Hey, it's all about winning every single game, right?
Yeah, exactly. Well, he's gone, so.
You really do see that he had some really nice spurts. I mean, even against Indiana, it must be an Indiana thing, but when he played Indiana in November, 3 for 4, 7 points, 1 for 1.
One of the best
three.
Defensive teams in the league, too. I mean, he's doing that against one of the best defensive teams in the Eastern Conference. Indiana was an excellent defensive team last year.
They were third best in points per game allowed in the NBA.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, look at this. This is some great stats right here. So in the two games in October, McDermott averaged 20 minutes a game. In November, he averaged 10.4. In January, he averaged 1. In February, 2.
Well, he was hurt.
In March, 9.7. In April, 3. Well, then fine, but he came back in March, 9.7, and then April he averaged 3. The games, what pulls him out of it. So he had 22 minutes against Charlotte, 4 for 6. Then he had 5 minutes the next game, 0 for 1. 7 minutes the next game, 0 for 3. So he only took 4 shots combined between those two games. Then he had 4 minutes against Toronto, 1 for 3. And then after that, nothing. I mean, he played 2 minutes against the Pistons, didn't take a shot, and he didn't take another shot for the entire season. Until Milwaukee, the last game of the Milwaukee series.
Oh, man, I can't wait to see. My dream is that Thibodeau gets a job with some team and McDermott scores like 60 points on that team. That'd be the best. And afterwards, he just goes right up to him and just slaps him in the face. It'd be awesome.
That would be.
All right, guys.
Give him an Italian
beef. Awesome having you on.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Andy. It was great having you.
Anytime. I'm here.
Man, that was great. It was a good time having you on. Yeah, we got to get Carrie and Chris on. For a big
absolutely
for a big
a Royal
match,
Rumble
wrestling match exactly. I'm down.
Let's get them on.
Did you try to get them on, Mark? What happened? I thought you were talking.
I did. Well, I mean, Chris kept saying no, and then he gave me like a smiley face for the last one. So, which I think is his way of saying I'm just going to walk away from this conversation and pretend like I have the guts to do this, but really not agree to do it. I was like, dude. Here's my number right now. Text me.
Well, in fairness to Chris, he probably only has a plastic phone. So I can't imagine. It's hard to get out, you know, from your parents' basement and make calls. They got to watch the bills.
If you're listening to this, Chris, that is an invitation right there, buddy. Come on. Bring it. Talk the talk. That's all we want. Bring it to the show.
Bring it on, brother. I'm kidding.
This
I know
the big
you
league.
Have a phone.
This is the big leagues.
All right, man.
All right, guys. Thanks for having me.
For coming on the show.
Andy Carnes.
Call Andy.
Call Andy at Andy Carnes, A-N-D-Y-K-A-R-N-S. Follow me at CBEFred, Chicago Bullseye Fred, at CBEFred, Mark, at Bullseye Mark 23.
I've said I'm going to do it. I've been tweeting.
And then I also want to say a shout-out to the Fedors, Brian Fedor, who's my good friend of ours, good listener out in California, and Dave Fedor, his brother, who helped me in the tournament this weekend, the golf tournament. God love you guys. All the best.
And
one
last
shout-out
to me. We didn't talk about this at all, but Mike Dunleavy today signed a 3-year deal. Back with the team for another 3 years. Hey, I mean, Mike Dunleavy, I don't want you to be starting next year, but you really – I mean, he definitely picked up his game. He expected to get paid more this year because he started for the majority of last year, and he certainly proved himself. You know, I'm happy to have Dunleavy back. I just hope that he's in a supporting role.
Absolutely. One last thing.
Yeah.
Go for it.
Can I plug my band?
Sure.
Yeah.
All right. Check out starbendermusic.com. It's my band I'm in. We play around Chicago. Check us out.
That's awesome. I was in a band back in the day. What kind of music do you guys do?
Sort of like a alternative rock with the 90s psychedelic sort of thing.
Awesome.
I'm going to check that out. That sounds good.
Yeah, send us a tune. We'll put it on the next podcast. Mark and I will break it down.
Yeah, for sure.
Sounds good.
Hey, last question for you. Aerosmith or who are we comparing? Aerosmith or Van Halen?
Van Halen.
That's what
out of those two bands?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would take, I mean, I'm not a huge fan of either. I definitely prefer Van Halen just out of guilty pleasure. I mean, they're both good. I mean, I'm more of a Pink Floyd, Beatles, Led Zeppelin guy. A little different.
Okay. Well, those are good.
So we're going to say that's inconclusive, Fred. That is inconclusive.
Yeah.
I mean, if I had to pick, I would go Van Halen, though.
All right.
I disagree. I respectfully disagree.
Okay.
But, hey, that's the beauty. That's the beauty of that's the beauty of this.
Two is greater than one. You lose, Mark.
Wait till we get our third guest on this show after 350 episodes, and maybe we'll ask them.
We'll see
what they
Steven say. Tyler. If you get Steven Tyler on, you might win.
I'm working
all right,
on it. I have front row stone seats this weekend, so I'll try to get Mick Jagger.
Oh my God! You gotta take pictures.
I will.
All right, guys. I gotta get the.
All right. Well, thanks again, Andy, and until next time, if it ain't bold,
it ain't basketball.
All right. Take
great
care.
Job,
thanks,
guys.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Thank you. Take care. Talk to you later. We'll be right back.